speaker for tonight, Steve Snyder. I've known him a long time now, and I've had his book almost from the start. I think it was nice enough to sign it for me. I just thought it was such a thrilling read. I think I just read it in 2 days because I couldn't stop. But anyway, enough about me. I'm going to turn it over to Steve, and thanks for being here, Steve. I'm really excited about this.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate being here. I am a CAF member. In addition to being the author of the book, I'm also the president of the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association and on the board of directors of the 8th Air Force Historical Society. We have our annual reunion coming up in about a month in Colorado Springs. Growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. He was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. He flew bombing missions over Europe, and on February 8th of 1944, his plane was shot down, and he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually got back to England. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. And my parents had kept a lot of material about the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it, learn more details. I had no intention of writing a book. And there were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote about his plane being shot down while he was missing in action, he wrote it, which is absolutely riveting. So much so that it was included in two books that have been written. On the left is The Mighty Eighth by Gerald Astor. It was about the 8th Air Force stationed in England. They flew high altitude, daylight precision bombing missions with the goal of hitting military and industrial targets to cripple Nazi Germany's ability to wage war. The 8th Air Force got the moniker the Mighty Eighth by noted historian Roger Freeman because of the number of bombers they could send up on these missions, which numbered into the hundreds. And on December 24th of 1944, 2,000 bombers hit targets around Berlin. I mean, that's hard to wrap your head around, 2,000 bombers. The other book was first over Germany. It was about the 306 bomb group that my dad was in. It was written by Russell Strong, who was a navigator in the 306 and became his historian after the war. Their motto was first over Germany because they were the first bomb group in the 8th Air Force to hit a target in Germany, Wilhelmshaven, on January 27th of 1943. The other item that was really significant were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England before being shot down. And my dad was really candid in these letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, talked about what life was like on the air base, talked about what life was like in England and London at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew and became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe. I went on the internet, spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I went on a quest to find all relatives of all my dad's crew and ask them for whatever information they could give me. Started to go into reunions, listen to veterans tell their stories. And finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling it needed to be told. So I decided to write a book. From the time I started my research to the time the book was published was 4.5 years. And the first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down, and then the second half of the book is all about what happens afterwards. And it's just not about my dad. It goes into detail about what happened to each member of the crew and also about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them. But I couldn't have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen. On the left with my dad with his bomber jacket is Dr. Paul Delahaye. That picture was taken in 1994 at the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium and my dad's plane being shot down. And then with me on the right is Jacques Lalot. That was taken 20 years later at the 70th anniversary. During the war, these two men were young boys, and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand atrocities committed against their family and friends by the Nazis. And later on in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground who were involved in the events involving my dad and his crew, and they documented their testimony. And they gave me unbelievable detailed information about events that would have been lost forever. So I owe them a huge debt. Initially, my dad didn't go into the Air Force as a result of the first peacetime draft in the fall of 1940, implemented by President Roosevelt. My dad went into the Army in April of 1941, and he was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. And at the time that World War II started, the U.S. military was woefully weak. They ranked 18th in military strength in the world, behind Romania. And also, you can tell by the World War I vintage uniform he had on here that they were very ill-equipped. 3 months later, in July, he married Ruth Hempel at First Lutheran Church in Pasadena. My mother was born and raised in Pasadena. It was shortly after she graduated from UCLA. I was also raised in Pasadena, and I also went to UCLA. My dad was born in Norfolk, Nebraska, and then he came out and moved to Glendale with his family before starting high school. A few months later, in December 7th, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, and the United States was at war. Well, my mother was very fearful. The future was very uncertain, so she decided to go visit my dad up in Washington over Christmas. And 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. Well, at the time, my dad was, concerned how he's going to support his family. He has a new bride, a baby on the way, and he didn't think he could do that very well in the private's pay in the Army. So he decided to volunteer for the Air Force. We could make more money, especially if he made it through pilot training and became an officer. So in June of 41, he went through pre-flight training at Santa Ana Army Air Base here, and then went through the various stages of pilot training. This slide's kind of busy. But it kind of goes through the various stages of pilot training. There were three main stages. One was primary, and if you made it through primary, you went into basic pilot training. And pilot training was really rough. 40% of the cadets that started washed out, and they became bombardiers or navigators or perhaps gunners. And then after basic, they separated the pilots out. They either went into single-engine planes, fighters, or two-engine planes, either transports or bombers. Typically, the shorter pilots went into fighters because of the cramped conditions in the cockpit. My dad was 6'3", so he went into twin-engine planes. But personally, I think it also was based on personality. It's my experience that fighter pilots tended to be pretty cocky, have big egos, risk-takers, whereas those bomber pilots tended to be a little more level-headed and team players. Here you see my dad at primary training at Santa Maria, California. This was a huge day for my dad because the first time he soloed. And back then, you couldn't wear your goggles on your helmet until you had soloed. So that was a big day for him. These are the three planes he flew in pilot training. Up top, you have the Sturm and biplane. And then in basic, Volte-Valiant single wing plane. And then advanced training to Curtiss Wright 18-9 twin-engine plane. My dad graduated from advanced pilot training in Douglas, Arizona in April of 1943, where he earned his commission as a second lieutenant in his pilot's wings. From there, he went to transitional crew training, where he learned how to fly a four-engine B-17 bomber. From there, he went to operational crew training, where the various members of the crew came together and they learned to operate as a team. And then once deemed ready, they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations. On October 21st of 1943, my dad and his crew reported to the 306 bomb group at Thurlow, about 60 miles north of London. This is what the base looked like at the time. The base isn't there anymore, but the rural countryside looks exactly the same. My wife and I have a visit. They have a nice little museum there that my wife and I would visit several times. Here you see the insignia of the 306 bomb group. In the 8th Air Force, there were three air divisions. The 306 was in the 1st Air Division, which was signified by a triangle. And then every bomb group had a letter designation, and for the 306, it was H. So the triangle H represented the 306. Besides being the first bomb group to hit a target in Germany, the 306 was also the longest-serving bomb group in the 8th Air Force. They arrived in England in September of 1942, and they didn't go back home until December of 1946. They stayed on after the war, involved in the Casey Jones Project, which was the aerial photo mapping of Western Europe and Northern Africa. Most all of you have probably seen the 1949 movie 12 O'Clock High, starring Gregory Peck. That was based on a true story about the 306 bomb group. The fictitious bomb group in the movie, the 918th, was derived by multiplying the 306 by three. Another distinction the 306 had is that their flight surgeon, Dr. Thurman Schuller, was responsible for convincing 8th Bomber Command General Ira Aker to implement a mission limit in April of 1943. Up until that time, there were no mission limits, and the morale of these combat crews was going into the tank because they realized they would never, ever make it home. They'd either be killed or shot down and become a prisoner of war. Dr. Schuller suggested a mission limit of 20. Aker set it at 25, but at least they had a light at the end of the tunnel and some goal that they could shoot for and try to, and hopefully make it home. Every bomb group had four bomb squadrons, either the four and the 306. Up in the upper left was the Clay Pigeons. They took more losses than any other bomb squadron in the 8th Air Force. My dad's bomb squadron is the 306th, fighting, biting in the lower right there. I always like to point out the ground crews. The combat crews got all the glory and recognition, but it was these ground crews that really kept these planes flying. After missions, these bombers would come back in all beat up. These ground crews would stay up all night long, usually in very inclement weather, sleet, snow, mud, rain, repairing battle damage, doing maintenance on the plane, replacing engines, tires, and what have you. And they took great pride in these planes. They really considered it their plane, and they just loaned it out to the combat crews occasionally to fly missions. So they are the unsung heroes. Here you see my dad's crew. A B-17 had a 10-man crew. There were four officers kneeling in front. My dad's on the lower left. He was the first pilot, and as such, the commander of the crew and the plane. And then going across, you have the co-pilot, the navigator, and then the bombardier. And then behind them, you have six enlisted men who were mainly gunners. Five of these men came home, but five did not. That's not the Susan Ruth there in front of. That's just another B-17 that they took their crew picture in after they arrived in England. I always like to point out the nose art. I love the nose arts. You know, it's interesting that the Air Force was the only entity that allowed their planes to be painted. The Marines didn't, the Navy didn't, and really the other countries didn't allow it. But the Air Force thought it could help the morale of these young guys if they could personalize their planes. And they're really creative in what they named and painted their planes. Many times it was a cartoon character, but more often than not, it was a scantily clad or a nude woman. You know, after all, these guys were in their late teens and early 20s and virile young men. The 306 flew B-17 bombers. The 1st Air Division and the 3rd Air Division flew B-17s. The 2nd Air Division flew B-24 Liberators. It was nicknamed the Flying Fortress because of the armament it had on the plane. It had 13 50-caliber machine guns, so it could put out a tremendous amount of firepower, and also it could take a tremendous amount of battle damage and keep flying. Every plane was identified by tail markings. You can see the triangle H of the 306th Bomb Group in the 1st Air Division. And then each had a serial number that was assigned by the manufacturer. Boeing designed the B-17 and produced 60%. But Lockheed Vega and Douglas Aircraft Corporation each produced 20% as well. In Europe, there were three models of B-17s flown. The first was the E model, but they only built 500 of those, so they were phased out very quickly by the F model. And then it was replaced in the fall of 1943 by the definitive B-17, the G model, which you can always tell by the chin turret underneath the nose. Here you see the crew positions on the plane. Again, this is the G model with the chin turret. You have the bombardier, navigator, two pilots, flight engineer, the bomb bay, radio operator, ball turret gunner, two waist gunners, and then the tail gunner. The bombs hung up in racks in the bomb bay. This is a little hard to see. Here are the bombs here. And it was really cramped in there. This boy is only 8 years old, and that catwalk is only 8 inches wide. If you've never been in a B-17s, you just won't realize how cramped these bombers were. They were it was tighter in a bomb B-17 than it was in a submarine. And occasionally on bomb runs, it wasn't uncommon for bombs to get hung up on these racks, which would require one of the crew members to either kick it loose with his foot or take a wrench and knock it loose. When those bomb bay doors are open, you're looking 5 miles straight down to the ground, so that took a little courage for them to do that. Here again, you see the crew positions a little clearer. This is the F model without the chin turret. Here you have the bombardier, his main job was to drop the bombs accurately. But in the G model, he manned the chin turret that was underneath the nose of the plane. And then the navigator, he needed to know where they were and where they were going. And when under attack by enemy fighters, he manned cheek guns that were on each side of the nose. And up above them, you have the first pilot in the left seat, you know, co-pilot in the right seat. And you needed two pilots to fly these planes, and not just because if one was killed or injured, you had another guy that could do the job. But it was physically and mentally stressful to fly these bombers. Back then, it took muscle to fly these bombers. And you had to fly in tight formation, so they had to be alert at all times so they could clip a wing on the bomber next to them and run into the plane in front of them and go down. And then they had to continually fight the air turbulence. You know, they had the air turbulence of just the weather, which all of you have experienced. But with all those bombers being in such tight formation, they had to fight the wake turbulence and prop wash of all those bombers being in such close proximity to one another. And above them, you have the flight engineer. He manned the top turret when they were under attack. He was also called the crew chief. He was an onboard mechanic and knew how everything worked. And he would help monitor the instruments in the cockpit. There were over 150 different gauges and dials and toggles and switches. And he'd peer over the pilot's shoulders to help monitor engine performance and fuel consumption. Then behind the bomb bay, you have the radio operator. He had the most comfortable position on the plane. He had his own compartment and a chair to sit at. And then the most cramped position on the plane, the ball turret gunner down here under the belly of the plane. And these missions were 6 to 10 hours in length, so it was tiring. He had to be in a fetal position for hours on end, so that was pretty uncomfortable. Then up above the ball, you had two waist gunners, which was the most exposed position on the plane, and another cramped position in the tail. My dad and his crew flew their first mission on November 3rd of 1943. It was a mission to Wilhelmshaven, Germany. It was the first time they put up over 50 bombers on a mission. And flying combat missions was brutal and extremely dangerous. 26,000 men died in the 8th Air Force, which is more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. Another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their planes were knocked out of the sky. Being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during World War II. And it was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed. At its peak, there are about 40 bomb groups in the Air Force located in an area called East Anglia, which is about the size of Vermont. And these bases were just located only about 5 to 10 miles apart. So on the day of a mission, you could have hundreds of bombers all taken off at the same time. And back then, you didn't have any air traffic control, there wasn't any radar, and usually the weather was socked in and you couldn't see anything until you got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon. And then they had to form up. Three plane elements formed up into combat squadrons. Combat squadrons formed up into combat groups. Combat groups formed up into combat wings. Combat wings formed up into air divisions. And all this took an hour to 2 hours before they could even head across the channel or the North Sea to begin their mission. And then they had to deal with the elements. These planes weren't pressurized, so above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen, or else they had a couple minutes to pass out and could die. And it was extremely cold at the altitude that they flew. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero. So frostbite was a big problem. One of my dad's waist gunners was in the hospital for 2.5 months from the seriousness of his frostbite injuries. Here you see a waist gunner in their combat uniform. That's a B-24, actually, not a B-17. But again, the nose art. But his steel helmet, his goggles, tinted goggles, oxygen mask. This is a flak jacket. That was an apron that had metal plates in the front and the back to help protect them. And then his fleece-lined jacket, pants, thermal boots, and gloves. This is the parachute harness. They didn't actually wear their parachutes in the plane because it was too cramped. If they needed to bail out, they had to have their wits about them to find their parachute and then clip it on hooks on the back of the harness and then bail out of the plane. The next thing they had to deal with was enemy fighters. The Germans had radar stations set up along the continental coast of Europe, so they knew when these bomber formations were coming, and they'd send up their air force, the Luftwaffe, to intercept them. Here again, you see a waist gunner with his flak jacket on and all these spent cartridges on the floor here. That's like step on our ball bearings or marbles, firing his 50 caliber machine gun. And then the ammunition came in belts of 27 feet in length. So if he fired the whole belt, they said he fired the whole 9 yard. And many people believe that's where that expression came from. At the beginning of the war, it was 8th Bomber Command's belief that these heavily armed bombers flying in tight formations of hundreds of bombers could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. And they flew in what was called a combat box formation. And this is the combat box of a combat wing. And then within the box of the wing, you have three boxes representing bomb groups. And then with each bomb group, you have three boxes representing bomb squadrons. So the thought was that all this interlacing firepower could ward off the Luftwaffe. Here you have another view of the plane from the front, from on top, and then from the side. It was a three-dimensional formation with a lead group, a high group, and then a low group. Unfortunately, 8th Bomber Command was sadly mistaken. These bombers could not defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. In the early years of the war, in 1942, 1943, they took devastating losses. And even when they realized they did need fighter escorts, the fighter planes at the time didn't have the fuel capacity to escort the bombers all the way into Germany and back. They could get across the English Channel, but then they'd run low on fuel and have to turn around and head back to their bases. It was particularly brutal in 1943. Even though they implemented that mission limit of 25 in April, it was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions. The average number of missions they flew that year was 6 before being shot down. And the losses culminated in October of that year in what's referred to as Black Week, when over four missions they lost 148 bombers. That's almost 1,500 men. With the worst day being Black Thursday, October 14th, when they sent 291 B-17s to hit the ball bearing factories at Schweinfurt, Germany, and 60 were shot down. The 306 lost 10 of the 15 B-17s that they sent up on that mission. Well, the 8th Air Force was in shock. There was no way they could sustain those losses, and they stood down from going flying missions into Germany for the rest of the year. It wasn't until right at the end of 43 and the beginning of 44 when fuel tanks were added to the P-47 Thunderbolts and the introduction of the P-51 Mustang that they finally had fighters that could escort them deep into Germany all the way to the target and escort them back. The P-51s were particularly effective. I don't know if anyone recognizes this plane. That's Tom Cruise's P-51 that he flew in Top Gun Maverick. I took that picture at the Planes of Fame Air Museum. I don't know if it's stored there anymore. But by the time D-Day rolled around, June 6th of 44, the Luftwaffe had been almost completely decimated. So the P-51s really won the air war over Europe. The next thing they had to deal with was anti-aircraft fire. This is a flak gun. Flak was the abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. And these were deadly weapons. They fired 25 shells a minute, and they were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that these bombers were flying. And these shells were filled with all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal that when they exploded, they'd burst out hundreds of feet and easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of these bombers. I mean, the skin was so thin on those B-17s, you could take a screwdriver and just poke it right through it. From a distance, they kind of looked like innocent black puffs, but once you got on that killing field, those puffs got bigger, the explosions became deafening. If a shell exploded near the bomber, it just violently rocked the ship. If a bomber was hit directly, it just basically disintegrate and disappear. Or if it knocked a wing off, that plane would just plummet 5 miles down to the earth. Even though it was so cold at that altitude, my dad said he would be sweating profusely and his clothes would be dripping wet with the adrenaline running through his body. When they neared the target, they reached a pre-designated point called the initial point of the IP where they started their bomb run. And at that time, the first pilot gave control over the plane to the bombardier who flew the plane through the Norden bomb site. It was hooked up to the autopilot of the plane. It was a revolutionary device. It was an analog computer that could calculate various factors such as the altitude the plane was flying, the speed of the plane, wind speed, wind direction, so they could accurately drop the bombs. And it was also highly secretive. These bombardiers took an oath that they would defend this with their life. But little did the U.S. know at the time that the Germans had a spy in the Norden bomb factory, Hermann Lange, and they knew all about the bomb site. Once the, here you see the bombardier looking through the crosshairs of the bomb site. Once he released the bombs, he'd go, "Bombs away!" And that would signal the first pilot to take control of the plane. He'd go to another pre-designated point called the rally point, where the bombers who made it through the bomb room would try to form up again and head back to their bases in England, where once again they'd have to face enemy fighters. And even when they got back to England, they faced all sorts of dangers. The weather could be socked in. They couldn't even find their bases. They could be running out of fuel. They could have dead or injured pilots on the plane. The plane might have sustained a lot of battle damage, you know, engines out, flight controls out, which resulted in crash landings where more airmen lost their lives. It was on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany, on February 8th of 1944, when my dad's plane dropped their bomb successfully, but the bomb bay doors got hit by flak, and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused a drag in the plane. They lost airspeed, and they fell behind the formation, heading back to England, and they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighters, who, like wolves or lions, came in for the kill, and they shot down the Susan Ruth in the air battle. But both those Focke-Wulf fighters were shot down at the same time. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick. It crashed and he died in the plane. And the other one piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out. During my research, one day my wife Glenda says, "Well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane?" And I'm thinking, oh, she's so naive. She has no idea what she's talking about. It'd be impossible. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do, and I found Hans Berger. And we became friends. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, so he could speak perfect German. And he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. He was scared to death. And I'll talk about him a little bit later. After my dad bailed out, well, I mentioned earlier that the book goes into detail about what happened to each member of the crew. I don't have time to do that tonight. You'll have to buy the book if you want to find that out. But after my dad bailed out, he came down in these trees right at the French-Belgium border. And his parachute got hung up in the branches, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground, and he couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Dervan, came to his rescue before the Germans got there. This happened in the early afternoon. They told my dad to stay put and hide because they thought they'd come back that night and get him, because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move in daylight with German patrols combing the area trying to find these guys that had bailed out. This is the tree. That's Henri Franken, and that's the tree that they helped my dad down. He sent these pictures to my dad after the war. There's over 200 time period photographs in the book, so you can visualize everything you're reading about, many taken by Belgian people, either sent to my dad or provided to me from Dr. Paul Delahaye and Jacques Lalot, who I mentioned earlier. So that night, they took him to the Dervan farmhouse, and that farmhouse is in Belgium, and those trees are in France, so it's right at the French-Belgium border. And he stayed there just one night, because again, they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer with those German patrols still in the area. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came on a tandem bicycle to take him to a safer location. So it was the middle of the night, pitch black, drizzly, and they headed out. My dad had some shrapnel wounds in one leg, so he could only pedal with his good leg. And they came up to a hill, and they had to get off the bike and start pushing it up the hill. And they came to this building. That's what it looked like in 1994. But during the war, it was a cabaret, a little cafe. The lights were on, music was playing, people were laughing. And all of a sudden, two German officers come walking out with these two French girls. One comes up to my dad, puts his arm around him, and asks for a light for a cigarette. My dad is petrified. He can't speak German. You know, he didn't know French at that time. But fortunately, Paul knew what they wanted and lit the guy's cigarette, and they let him go on their way. My dad said these German officers were too drunk and too interested in these young girls to pay much attention to them pushing a bike up in the middle of the night. And after that, my dad was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed in any given location depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night, might spend 6 weeks. Here you see my dad with a few of his helpers. He had many more helpers than this. At 6'3", he was much taller than the locals, so they stuck a beret on him to help him try to blend in. I don't know how effective that was, but the people who hid my dad, or any down airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of their family and friends, because if the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, they would be arrested, tortured, and either shot or sent to a concentration camp. And some of the people who held my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate. Here you see a couple women that my dad spent lengthy periods of time with. On the left is Gisèle Bayou. It was with her and her husband, Maurice, that my dad wrote that diary that I mentioned earlier. And then on the right is Jeanette Gadin. He spent time with her on a couple different occasions. Her husband was a captain in the French army who was captured in 1940 when Germany first invaded the lowlands, and he spent the remainder of the war as a POW. Normally when the underground came across down airmen, they tried to get them back into England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees, into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out, and it became very frustrating. And he had several occasions that are described in the book where he was almost discovered by the Germans. And so he got tired of hiding, and he decided to join the French resistance. Word came on June 6th that the Allies had landed at Normandy, and he decided to get back into the fight. Unlike most airmen, he had that year's experience in the army and the infantry, so he knew how to fight on the ground, unlike most airmen who just went straight into the Air Force. I mean, this was extremely dangerous for him to do, and his helpers tried to talk him out of it because he could die fighting against the Germans, or if they captured him, he'd be shot on the spot as a terrorist. But he felt it was his duty to get back in the fight. There were other Americans fighting and dying for their country, and he felt that obligation. I don't know how many men would have made that decision. I'll describe one occasion he was almost discovered. This is the Bayou home in Charleroi. At night, middle of the night, there was a loud pounding on the door, and Germans, and Maurice told my dad to get up on the roof, and then he'd come get him after the Germans left the area. Well, they never left the area. They stayed there all night, so my dad stayed on that roof the entire night. And I've been in this house. I've been in all these places where my dad was hidden, and you can't see it from this angle, but there's a little attic up on top and a little tiny window that you have to crawl out of, and it's a tile roof. It's really steeply sloped, so I can't imagine climbing out there and being up there in that roof all night. But I mentioned there's other examples of him almost being discovered. Getting back to joining the French resistance, he convinced Amy Cools, one of his helpers, to accompany him down across the French border to meet up with a unit of the French resistance. This is not the group that my dad joined, but it gives you an idea of what they look like. They were called the Mackie. They were independent, small, ragtag guerrilla groups located all across France. And they just harassed the Germans. They attacked convoys, disrupt communications, sabotage railroad lines, assassinated German officers. And they got their information over the BBC through the British through coded messages. And my dad said the information they gave him was unbelievably accurate. If they said a convoy was coming down in this road on this date at this time, sure enough, they would be there. And that was a result of the British cracking the German Enigma code and knowing everything that they were up to. Here's the farmhouse that they stayed in Wallers, France. Here you see my dad standing in front of it in 1994. He stayed in this tower up here. We see these windows. On one occasion, it was early in the morning. He just had his skivvies on and shaving cream on his face. And he looked out, and the German patrol was coming up the road. So he had to jump out of these windows and back and hightail it in the woods to avoid being caught. Who took this picture and however got to my father, I don't know. But that's him fighting with the French resistance in 1944, 81 years ago. Finally, on September 2nd, about 7 months after he bailed out, word came that there were U.S. troops in Treslong, France. So he walked into the town square, went up to an army major. Actually, it was a unit of Patton's 3rd Army, which had come up through France after D-Day. Identified himself. They interrogated him to make sure he was who he said he was. Then he caught a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris. Then he hopped on a transport and got back to his base in England, where he sent a Western Union telegram to my mother saying, fit as a fiddle, back at base, bank the money, honey, because he had all that back pay coming to him. Belgium's a wonderful little company. A lot of people don't realize it's really divided in two. The upper half of Belgium is called Flanders, where they speak a dialect of Dutch, Flemish, and this more highly populated and industrial. And then the lower part of Belgium is called Wallonia, where they speak French, and it's all rural farmland. And my dad and the plane and the crew members that were able to bail out came down right about here. Actually, my dad and the plane came down in Belgium, and the other guys that were able to bail out came in down in France, and they were brought back into Belgium, either by Germans who captured them or by members of the French resistance. And then my dad was hidden in Charleroi for a while, and then the farmhouse where the Mackey group stayed in Trelon, France, where he was liberated, is right around here. The French, the Belgian people are wonderful people. To this day, they are so thankful and so grateful for the Americans and the Allies coming to rescue them from 4 years of Nazi occupation and oppression. And Dr. Delahaye in 1984 started the Belgium American Foundation to remember and honor the events that took place and started building memorials to remember these events, and they have ceremonies on the anniversary of those events. But the big celebrations are all centered around September 2nd, which is the day that that area of Belgium was liberated. And they're wonderful events. This is a poster from the 70th anniversary. I just went to the 80th anniversary last year, but they last several days. They erect these big tents. That's a partial of just one tent. Seats hundreds of people, and they have band concerts and dances and lunches and dinners. The local volunteers dress up in period costumes, and the local beer, Chimay, just flows. And it's everyone has a great time. But they have ceremonies that are different memorials that are solemn locations. This is at Cendron, which was right at the French-Belgian border, where the U.S. 9th Infantry first crossed over the Wartroz River from France into Belgium to liberate the country. And the U.S. military is represented, French military, Belgian military, all the villagers come out. The ambassador, U.S. ambassador of Belgium, comes down with a big entourage. And they're just wonderful, moving events. They do a great job of educating the younger generations, too. As you can see here, they put these younger people just right up front. This is a memorial of Mackinaws to the crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. It's about 200 yards from where the plane came down. And that was dedicated in 1989. And before that, my dad, like most World War II veterans, didn't talk a lot about the war. But he and the three other crew members that were still living at the time went over for the dedication of the memorial. And there he was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him during the war, taken around to the places where he was hidden. And that brought it all back. And he started talking about it after that. And then my first trip to Belgium was 1994 with my parents. And that's when it became personal for me, because I saw these things firsthand. This is my dad at the dedication of the memorial. Dr. Delahaye that I showed you earlier, that's my dad. This is Jeanette Gaudin that I showed you in that one picture, with her and Ghislaine Bayou. This is Nellie Tilcan. That was the wife of that customs officer, Paul Tilcan. A couple months after he helped my dad, he was arrested by the Gestapo, thrown in prison and tortured, and narrowly escaped being executed. But he, because of the brain damage he had from the beatings, he had developed a tumor, and he died just a few years later. And then this is Raymond Durvan, the other man that helped my dad down from the trees after he bailed out. Again, I made my first trip with my parents in 1994. A few years ago, I was a little younger there. It's my dad, my mother, and then this is my sister Nancy. She was born while my dad was missing in action. So that was really tough on my mom, having one-year-old Susan and infant Nancy. I've never known if she'd ever see her husband again. I've been to Belgium 8 times, and I love going over there. I'd go every year if I could. On 2 of those occasions, I contributed on to Munich, Germany, to meet Hans Berger, that pilot that shot down my dad's plane. And I learned from Hans that the gunners on my dad's plane shot him down at the same time he shot my dad down. They shot each other down. He bailed out three times. Almost all his friends were killed during the war. He shot down one Spitfire and seven B-17s. I think the only reason he made it through the war is that right at the beginning of 1945, he was pulled out of combat to become a test pilot for the Heinkel HE-162 single-engine fighter that they were trying to perfect, which they never did. But Hans and I became friends, and I had hoped to see him last year when I went over for the 80th anniversary, but he died in January of 2024 at age 100, so I wasn't able to see him one last time. Here we are at his apartment, and he's wearing his fighter jacket, and you can't see his Iron Cross that he has on there. And then this is up at the Hofbrauhaus in Munich, having a cold one. This picture is me and my dad in 2004. He wanted to go see the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. before he died, so I accompanied him on a reunion of the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society. And that was a great trip, but it was the last one he ever took. He died 3 years later in 2007. He wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest at 91. Now, you know, all the World War II veterans, they're all pretty much in their hundreds. There were 16 million veterans. And that number, as you can see from the graph, has dwindled. Today, there's less than 0.5% of these men still with us. At our reunion, 8th Air Force reunion coming up next month, there's only one World War II veteran that's going to be able to be there. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died, millions more were wounded, millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of the world in America forever. And the brave young men who fought and died for freedom are the greatest generation, and their sacrifice must never be forgotten. It's our duty to remember. Thank you. If anyone has any questions, I'll handle a few. Yes, sir.
Where do you hold the 8th Air Force reunion?
We moved from city to city this year. It's in Colorado Springs. Last year it was in New Orleans. Next year it's in San Antonio. And then the year after that in Savannah, where the 8th Air Force Museum is.
Steve, to add to your situation as far as the Belgian people, my wife and I went over to Normandy, and we were actually out on the National Cemetery. We were looking for family members that had fought over there during that period of time. And while we were walking across the graveyard markers, this man, approximately 6'5", probably 300 pounds, heard us speaking English and came running at us. And of course, I was a little intimidated by all this. And he walked over and he said, "You are from America? You're Americans?" I said, "Yes, we are." And he gave me this giant bear hug and hugged my wife. He said, "My grandmother and my mother said, every American I ever see deserves a thank you."
Amen.
They were wonderful people. We sat out there for probably 2 hours and talked. I just want to let you know that was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, I've developed so many close friends over there. I'm friends with the grandkids of people who hid my dad. And some of my, five airmen in the shot down story are buried, four at Margroten and one in Belgium. And I'm friends with the grave adopters of those. And you build these ties with these people. It's just fantastic.
Steve, as you mentioned, when we were in Le Save, France, 6 years ago, Vidal dropping the reenactor paratroopers, the Belgians had full-on gear, meaning they had all the armament, the bazookas, the Garands, the Tommy guns. They had everything. Those guys were just fanatical about the reenactment.
Yeah, and when we have when you go to these ceremonies, there's all these Belgians set up a full army camp with all their vehicles, and they reenact the 9th Ninth Infantry crossing over the Wartroz River, you know, and all the villagers get out there and everyone applauds, and then following the vehicles are all these people, you know, dressed up in period clothing from the war, representing, you know, refugees that had fled to France and then coming back, you know, into Belgium. They're just fantastic.
Hmm. I was wondering, how long, in my set this, so I apologize, how long was your dad missing in action before he was able to tell his wife? And then you said your sister was born...
Why he was missing in action. Okay, Nancy.
So how long... I'll read the book.
Well, he was shot down on February 8th.
Okay.
And on February 23rd, my mother got a telegram from the War Department, okay, where all the wives or mothers, you know, got the telegram saying he was missing in action.
And she's pregnant.
Yeah.
Okay. And then when again?
Well, he got back and sent the telegram on September 6th. So it was a little over, about 7 months. About 7 months. Well, when you read the book, it's funny. I'll let you read the book. By the way, it's $25 cash or credit card, if anyone's interested. I will say one other thing. After my dad came back to England, they sent him back to the States to become a B-17 flight instructor. They had a rule at the time that if you were shot down and helped by the underground, you couldn't go back in combat, because they thought if you were shot down a second time, captured by the Germans and tortured, you'd give up the identity of the people that helped you the first time. The only exception to that that I know of is Chuck Yeager, who personally met with General Eisenhower and talked him into going back into combat. So thanks again.
Thank you.
It's worth getting the book.